Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Lab CIO and Informatics Roundtable. The presenters are Lee Barnard, CEO and founder, LDX Healthcare Consulting, LLC, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and J. Mark Tuthill, MD, Division Head, Pathology Informatics, Henry Ford Health, Bloomfield Hills, Michigan.
My name is Mark Tuthill. I'm the Division Head of Informatics at Henry Ford Health. Thank you for joining us today. We are going to be talking from the perspective of the CIO of the laboratory, not that you necessarily have to be a CIO to participate in this. How many of you out there are actually in the C-suite? Okay. Anybody a Chief Medical Information Officer? An actual CIO? Okay, one hand going up. So the rest of us are all just interested in what we need to be visioning and planning to run our labs would be the way I would take this away. So, you know, what do we mean when we talk about being a CIO and why is this a CIO roundtable? And I think the real idea here is we're talking about strategy, we're talking about vision, and we're talking about how do we address and solve the problems that we face in our individual laboratories. So the idea that Lee and I originally had was that we would break this out for about 50 minutes, identify some of the key topics, and then in the second hour, we'd get together in some smaller interactive groups. When we saw that there were 60-plus people signed up, we got a little bit nervous about trying to pull that off in a room this size. So we decided we'd maybe shift tactics, but now seeing the actual number of people that are in the room, we might be able to shift tactics back. One of the things that I promised Robert I would be able to do, and one of the reasons I think he asked me to participate this, is that I'm fairly nimble on my feet. I'm flexible. I'm able to shift the way we approach things. So we'll wait and see what actually happens, but it doesn't really stop what we're going to try to do in the first 50 minutes. We will take a 10-minute break so that we can get out of this room. I'm sure it's not going to cool down that much. And take a little bit of a bio break, get some liquids, and we'll come back and we'll do the hard work of identifying how we solve these issues or how you've tackled them in your own institutions. Yeah. Sound right?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay,
yeah.
So we'll be a little flexible. If our number increases significantly, we'll change. Otherwise, I think we might be able to do the breakouts we initially planned. So with that being said, I am not a CIO. I am not in the C-suite. But I am the division head of an informatics department that covers six hospitals. We're an integrated laboratory service line, so I effectively operate as a chief lab information officer for about a $1 billion laboratory. So if you think about it, there are many smaller companies that got CIOs, and this is kind of my job. Right now, my name tag says division head. And it doesn't even say division head of what. I guess I can just make that up as I go along. But the reality is this is focused on laboratory. We're focused on the problems that we face in laboratory, and obviously we're talking about quasi-information technology-related problems. So I just want to set the stage and kind of frame what we're here to talk about today. So any questions or thoughts on how we're approach this before we get going? And I share with you what keeps me awake at night. I thought that's how we'd start out. And so I actually wrote down what keeps me awake at night, and I kept adding to the list, and it kept getting longer. And then I realized what really keeps me awake at night is the fact that I can't think through everything that I need to think through today, so I have to think about it all night long so that I can wake up tomorrow and start again. And sometimes that's not even really topical. But there are some key things that make me worry about what happens in our laboratories every day to help us get our work done. And I think top of the list that I wrote down, at least when I was writing this out most recently, was security. And when I think about security, I'm not just thinking about hackers on the outside. I'm thinking about, is our data safe? Are things backed up? Do we have appropriate disaster recovery plans? Have we really thought out how we're going to provide access for people? Remote access has become an increasing challenge. So we want to have remote sign-out, but we can't get people to be able to log on outside the healthcare system. So security, I think, is a big blanket area that we can talk a lot about. We all know healthcare is a target. We're walking around with targets on our back because there's a lot of varied information that if you get at in the healthcare system, you've got all the keys you need to move forward to make financial compensation. And that's not even really talking about things like ransomware. We're just talking about basic old steal the information and use it to make money. So that's probably number one on my list. Totally different topic, mergers and acquisitions. Why is that important to an informaticist? Well, first of all, if you're going to acquire, all of a sudden you got all this work you need to do, especially if you acquire a healthcare system that's got 9 hospitals and they're using completely different information technology platforms. Your IT group is involved with standing it up, and lab is not even in the middle or beginning of the conversation. And so this has come at me many times in my career, and it's coming at me again. So this is not just keeping me up at night in theory. It's keeping me up at night in actuality. So mergers. And then, of course, for anybody who was here with Dr. Crawford's discussion about Project Santa Fe and Lab 2.0, we all know that the ability for us to be commoditized and sold off is not difficult to do. So how do you create strategies that make the lab sticky? And one of those key strategies, in my opinion, is our data. And so as an informaticist, as a CIO perspective, the data is important to these mergers and acquisitions. Deployment of new technology. Oh, we love new toys. I love new toys. I love standing up new toys. The pace of the arrival of the new toys is absolutely extreme right now. And a lot of it is really disruptive. So we can throw into here AI, machine learning, as part of that new toy part that causes to stay awake at night. What's happening in molecular diagnostics, all the new instrumentation that keeps coming down the line at us. And then we can put a little subtext in here called the whole LDT snafu, right? So this is all related, in my opinion, to deployment of new technologies. And we can throw into that this increasing and relatively modern need for analytics and the way that analytics is used across laboratory to not only drive our business decisions, but going back to that merger and acquisition piece to justify our value and why you want to keep your lab local and not see that disappear. Obviously, reimbursement challenges. So now we can get into the whole pay for performance bit, whether we're getting reimbursed or not, how do we take care of our monies? Do we know what we're actually getting paid to do our laboratory testing? To me, this all kind of comes under the rubric of reimbursement changes and understanding how to be prepared for value-based care. And what will that mean for information technology? Well, our justification really comes down to our data. And then the final thing, and I guess I kind of got at it with the deployment of new technology, but I'll refer to it as the molecular and molecular genomics roller coaster. I mean, this is just a constant churn of new technologies, new opportunities, demands from clinicians, not just oncologist clinicians anymore, but all of the primary care physicians, the role of pharmacogenomics, the fact that if you don't have a pharmacogenomics program and you harm a patient because they were sensitive to a particular drug, you might be on the hook for not having provided appropriate care. So these things all, in my way of thinking about this, relate back to laboratories. So I'll summarize my list fast. Security, mergers and acquisitions. Oh, did I say workforce? No, I didn't say workforce, right? Do all that stuff, no workforce, right? Deployment of new technologies, disruptive technologies, including AI, ML, analytics development, reimbursement changes, and the molecular roller coaster. So that was supposed to be 5.
Yeah.
I think it was 8.
It was 8, yeah.
So let's turn the tables and maybe explore some of those topics with the goal being to identify maybe the top 3 or 4 that we really want to delve into, because the goal here is not to have talking head experience. The goal is to identify the issues, share experiences, how you have common experiences, how you have separate experiences, and then what are your strategies to address these things in your institution that someone in the room can take back with them to their own institution. Okay?
Who wants to start?
Go. So on the data side, Joshua from Moffitt Cancer Center.
Yeah, please identify yourself when you speak up. We were going to do an icebreaker, but I think we're kind of in between sizes.
Yeah. So you talked about data and security. So something that we've done, even within our organization, is create honest brokers. So who is allowed to access the data, be it from the business team, the clinical team, the laboratory team, and identifying key subject matter experts who are allowed to access specific data sets. And so we created an honest broker system, and that's really helped. But it's all guided by a data governance committee.
Good.
So you have to have an enterprise-wide data governance committee create policies and processes that are then implemented and trickle down across the enterprise.
Right.
So that's worked for us.
So is this a, when you say honest broker, are you referring specifically to use of data in research, or are you talking about access?
Research access, but now it's crossing into operational, clinical, and financial data too.
So is your strategy around data, is that part of IT, or is it part of a chief data office? Is it
so
separate?
We have a chief data officer.
Good.
So
okay.
We have something called the Center for Digital Health.
Yep.
So we have data, IT, informatics, and innovation.
Yeah.
And so all our data is managed by our chief data officer, who has data scientists and data engineers, et cetera.
Good. And they set the policies, procedures, and
correct.
And that,
with feedback from business owners.
Sure. Makes sense.
Okay, so this is a different, I'd say this is a different theme. It maybe quasi-relates to security, but in fact it's actually utilization of the data in a transparent...
There's also data access, which is data security.
Correct. Right. Yeah, it definitely relates to security, but you're talking about how do we use this clinically and do it in an ethically responsible fashion without compromising privacy, et cetera.
Correct.
Okay, great example. Another example or an underscore of any of the examples I threw at you all earlier. Again, we're trying to identify the top four or five things that we really want to explore deeply here.
Yeah. From our experience, you know, leadership will come to the IT staff and say, we've got to implement AI. So how much of that is actually happening in your organization? And they ask you the question, what are we going to do? Well, what's the plan? So what's your thoughts on implementation of AI? Solutions. Are you involved with that? Is the leadership engaged? Are they setting realistic expectations? What goes on with that?
My name is Vitaly. I'm CEO at Blood Services. Excuse me for kind of answering question with a question, but what do they want to implement AI for when they ask?
That's exactly right. I mean, those are the questions as we get.
I wish I could give you a better answer,
but no, I mean, that, and that's. They don't know, right? And
is anybody doing it? Is anybody in this room being asked to implement AI? Yes, ma'am.
I have been asked, but I'm April Poitier. I'm Senior Director of Operations at Aspiral Women's Health. So I've been broaching the conversation of it, and I am talking to leadership about it.
Good.
And we don't know what we want to use it for, so I've made some suggestions where we could possibly use it for strategy, data gathering, external reports to help us pull together like summaries of understanding, almost utilized as a personnel, or you know, like an IT personnel, AI personnel that we can kind of bring in and kind of fill in some of those gaps versus hiring a consultant to do it or a whole, you know, person to do it. So if we can avoid hiring a FTE, and it's had this, and it spits out fast, it can help us to organize some of our strategies.
Yeah.
And do some of the work that others don't really need to do.
Sure.
I guess part of the answer is first answer in the journey is to understand, what you're going to use AI for.
I agree.
And in fact, at this point, I would really turn the tables again, not to you guys, but to the organization. Basically, I think it's... largely upon us as a thought leaders and a team to lay the path to explain to our organization that's what you can use AI.
Yeah.
And that's how you practically utilize it, make the conversation practical. And that will shape the next steps of how you go
I think the problem is for most of us, if not all of us, is that because it's new and it's emerging, that we don't know what we don't know, and it's a matter of understanding the full capabilities of it as of right now. Because today, it's one thing. Next month, it'll be something else, because mm-hmm. it is growing and changing so rapidly. You know, it's different than ChatGPT, right?
So. Yeah, I'm actually impressed at how few people sitting in the audience said, yeah, we're being asked to do this, and no one can say, well, this is what we're doing. By the way, does Lab already use AI?
Yes.
All over the place, right? This is not new to us, is it?
Yeah.
Right? This is not new. So what is the new part of AI?
It's new applications.
New applications.
As AI is more and more capable, now you can actually utilize it more. So the latest, for quick example, right? The latest generation of generative AI can really write an appeal for you better than most professionals. Are you utilizing that? I don't know, but that's not what
you need. You know, and I think you really have to caution your leadership to, when they approach you as an IT executive to implement technology without a business plan, that's not a good plan. You know, because technology should not be leading the business. The business should be driving the demand, and then you as CIOs and executives in IT should be coming up with the ideal solution to fit the business. And I think to your point, you've got them thinking about that right now, and if they're not thinking about it, you've got to make them uncomfortable and tell them to start building a business model where they feel AI could potentially help them, and then you can implement the solution. And I think you're going to end up with a much better outcome in that.
So, April, you're a thought leader. You're a thought driver in your organization. And so we'll say AI is possibly one of our topics that we'll explore. And is there anybody that can help April with that thought leadership? And can you share what your strategies are? And again, we're kind of focused on Lab, right, as we're talking about this. And we know that there's a lot that we do in Lab that uses AI already, but are there ways that we can make that more clear to our organization? Is that appealing to them? Does that create some of that stickiness in Lab? Yes, sir.
Yeah, so I'm Tyler Throckmorton, Director of Software Development at Gravity Diagnostics over in Kentucky. We've used AI in two different places in our lab. One was actually 7 years ago, and one more recently. But they're not necessarily entirely new use cases. They're just being utilized in new ways. So the first one, and you've already said it, is data analytics. So understanding your revenue returns, your denials, your rates, denials, getting all of that very large data that may not be coming from a discrete data source, it might be something you're receiving in faxes or emails, aggregating all that data together in a way that the best example would be last summer when there was that big issue that happened in July with Medicare and how labs had to pay back tons of money. This system was actually able to identify that was happening weeks before any of the analysts noticed it, because it's monitoring all those things. It's seeing anomalies in the denial rates. It's like, I expected a few, but I got 100 more than I expected. So that's one way. It's just large data analysis. The other way that we're using it was a lot more back in the pandemic. So everybody was having hiring problems back in the pandemic. And so we were processing tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of COVID tests, and having to understand and interpret those results on a large scale was complex. And so having an analyst confirm the results at the end, but what we did is we actually designed an AI solution that interpreted the peaks and valleys of the results and gave its interpretive result that an analyst just had to confirm.
Mm-hmm. Good. Mm-hmm.
Just to piggyback on his thought, and this is also for April, everybody, I guess, for Moffitt Cancer Center, what we really invested was in revenue cycle management, right? Not just pathology. If you want to show your leadership team a return on investment, start AI in revenue cycle management. Mm-hmm. That's going to be, because there's more discrete data in revenue cycle management than in other areas, at least in my experience. And so it's easier for the algorithms to pick up on that data, identify patterns, like the gentleman said. Mm-hmm. And so if you're an organization that is nascent in AI, RCM is definitely a good gateway to get you know, dip your toes and really understand it.
Mm-hmm. This sounds like a good theme that might be valuable for the whole group. I mean, is to explore just some of these solutions in detail. Because we know that, you know, if we'd separate AI into two big camps, right, you've got the sort of generation, the novel creation aspects of AI, which is what's so sensational right now, right? The AI will write for you. The other side of it is the analytics part of AI, which is a little less new. We've been doing it for a long time, but I think there's a lot of squeeze in there that we get a lot of value out of, and labs can definitely help capture revenue. They can help identify failures. We can even use it around outcomes, so we can shift that over the clinical side of the house now, again, kind of going back to Dr. Crawford and Lab 2.0 to identify where we have got gaps in care we're providing, which makes the lab stickier to an organization. By the way, if all that data goes out to a large reference lab and you don't have it locally, how are you going to do what you guys just talked about? Right? You've got to have the data. One of the nice things about revenue is the pipeline for analyzing the data is not that challenging, as opposed to how do we get surgical pathology images into an AI pipeline that does analysis and helps us diagnose cancer. That's a much more complicated equation than what you're talking about right there, Joshua. All right. AI sounds like a pretty strong theme.
Yeah.
Anybody else out there want to just shift horses?
Yeah, because I was thinking, Mark, you know, one of the things, you know, these are all proactive planning, you know, improve the business, and then you've got the reactionary things that happen, you know, the elephant in the room, change healthcare, right? So that hits your organization, and how, you know, how is that impacting, you know, what you do, how you react? Now, are you moving into disaster recovery, leadership saying, what are we going to do to prevent this? So, you know, you got the proactive planning, the things you want to do to grow the business, and then you got the things to protect the business and change healthcare. I'm sure sooner or later somebody has probably approached you in that and like to hear a little bit about, you know, what your plans to deal with those types of issues, because it's the big elephant in the room and it didn't go away pretty quickly. So just throwing some ideas out there if that's something that you're up against and how you're handling that.
What type of... this is the part, and I think this is where people are not using it. What other systems are doing some of this stuff? Like, if I wanted to protect the business, I wouldn't even know where to turn.
Yep.
As far as, you know, training something, you know, to do what I needed it to do.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the new technologies for AI that we could utilize?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is out there and very nebulous. You know, I2B, coming out of Ann Arbor, small and innovative company. And there are many innovators here in this organization or at the War College that probably have concrete ideas. One thing I do want to stay away from is getting too deep into vendor suggestions, right, because we want to keep this kind of high level. But your question is absolutely pertinent, okay? AI's all out here. Where do I go get mine? You know, where do I take my shopping cart to buy my little AI module that's going to help me do the work that I'm trying to do? And the answer is it ain't built, right? There's very little of this. If you look at companies that do a lot of revenue monitoring, they're clearly doing this kind of work. So that's probably where you find yourself, April.
And I think back to the point of defining what the business requirements are, and then you can take that, you know, you don't have to go through the rigor of doing a really deep dive into an RFP, but if you can put information out there to vendors and let them come back to you and prove that they can handle the use cases that you're asking for, the business is going to drive the best selection of the vendor. And that's going to weed things out pretty quickly, too.
I mean, with AI, it all comes down to you have to know what the question is before
you
can go to the solution.
True.
You know what the question is.
True.
There are companies out there that are both established or startups that are in the AI space that might be working on that solution, like the example I gave of RCM.
True.
But if it's not established and it's not out there, but you know what your question is, then that leads down the path of the whole of, do we build it ourselves? Do we create a startup ourselves to go create it for others? And that's when you then start getting into the deeper discussion of the technology of, do you want to use Python to do it? Do you want to use Microsoft's new .NET and Azure? Because the technology is growing rapidly. And so there are a million and one different ways.
Yeah, and it, yeah, that shifts your model too, because you're becoming a software company now, right? You're really getting into an area that, if you're a lab for business, you know, for profit, you know, developing software 100%. Is a whole other line of business that you have to be prepared, and that also increases your liability as well. Okay,
increased liability, and also turns you, like you said before, it also turns you more into a cost center as well.
Yep,
because until that actually yields results and gives you positive outcomes, you're just spending money that you aren't guaranteed to get back.
Great.
Yep, and you're kind of off mission, really.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, coming from LabCorp, I've been there, you know, I was there for quite a while, and, you know, you couldn't form a committee without having 100 people in there. So I think it starts with forming, you know, a very small group of people to start putting together some ideas. I mean, because you got to start somewhere to begin that domino. And once you've at least established some of the initial thoughts on what you're looking to achieve and accomplish, then I think you can open it up to the broader organization. Because if you don't give them some ideas like we're doing here and you're sharing with us, you're never going to get to the end point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of committees. We weren't very successful at LabCorp. It's not their fault. They're just a big company. And the way they're structured, it just didn't lend itself to really have that groupthink type of discussion. But the business should really be driving it, and you got to start somewhere and get them out of fantasy land that is just not a plug and play type thing either.
Mm-hmm. Sir?
Yeah, I think there's also the change of thinking. How much ahead of informatics for students? We all trying to shell a project into an AI category, right? We all jump in that category. I think it's the opposite approach, right? We got discussion here. It's define the problem state, and then you define if AI can solve it or not. Not everything's going to be solved by AI.
And that's important, too, because I think that false expectation, and, you know, you don't know what's motivating your leadership team. You know, everybody's got this fear, hey, it could be a workforce reduction issue. And, it, you know, that's based on what? There's no fact. I mean, that's just a scare tactic, and they think that's going to help. But to your point, AI may not solve what they think it's going to be. So I think building the use case out and then applying technology is going to go a long, long way to really get your organization on the right track.
So let me make a heretical statement. I think we're in the very early phases of AI, sort of like 2000 and when they came up with that www thing in front of all the little URLs that we see, and no one really knew what that was going to be. They couldn't envision amazon.com yet, right? We couldn't envision cloud-based storage. So AI will probably have similar applications, but does AI replace the need to do a good job in your lab testing, right? It's kind of an added value. And I think things like revenue really lend themselves to that. When we start to get to clinical care, it starts to get really complicated. And then when I hear people talk about wanting to use generative AI in clinics to generate documentation, clinical documentation, it scares the heck out of me. And that's getting talked about right now. In fact, that's probably, at Henry Ford, that's probably the biggest actual use of AI, a generative AI that's going on right now. We're talking about using generative AI to capture interactive actions with patients to create clinical notes. It's a little bit scary if you think about it. And who's going to QC that? These guys don't have time to generate the notes anyway, which is why they want to use generative AI to generate the notes. Now, who goes back and says, well, what did the patient actually say? I suppose it's all recorded, like everything is now. But it's a, you know, it's an interesting challenge. So we've got clinical use of AI. We've got the operational use of AI in terms of generating our revenue. And then there's all the other myriad uses of AI that we haven't even gotten to. Things like multi-analyte analyses, where we can take 25 lab tests and compare them to a reference study. And this is happening right now where you can use ripple down technology and you can get the same derivative diagnostic information from five cheap tests that you get from the $2,000 definitive test. So there's a couple of different areas that we've been exploring here in AI. I just wanted to kind of call that out a little bit. We really didn't even talk about that last one, which is creative use of AI in diagnoses. Yes, sir.
Yeah, David Brown from Kaizen Digital Informatics. I think some of the issue is education of the executives.
Sure.
And machine learning has been used for years.
Years.
And analytics and stuff. So it's like we have this buzz. And I pity you guys who are getting peppered by your administration to implement AI in some way because it's an education problem.
Yeah,
really good point.
You know,
it's hype, right?
Well,
getting people to understand we've been doing this, and this is how we can do it better. And this is so now more and more people understand what it is. So now they have a term involved with it that's sexy, so to speak, and we want to implement it. But we've been doing it.
Yeah. So in research on this topic, the eight categories that I found that are currently being used today with AI in clinical laboratories are the following. I'll just give you the categories. Automation and robotics, in production today. Image analysis, it's there today. Predictive analytics, over there, and you talked about that. Natural language processing, it's been around for a while. Genomics analysis, quality control, drug discovery, and a virtual system, okay? And I think if you can build these categories of ideas for an organization that's trying to build out the AI technology, that at least you can get them focused on what area within the laboratory you want to implement. And these are actually in production today. These are the top eight areas that AI is being used today. And that really helps, to your point, education and focus and, you know, April, get, you know, trying to herd the people to tell you what they want, and I think you give them those ideas, and those categories are available in solutions today. Okay.
And there are different shopping carts, to your point, April. You know, where do I take my shopping cart for the revenue cycle piece? Where do I take my shopping cart for the virtual assistant? By the way, anybody using a virtual assistant in their customer service area? Okay. Good. This gentleman here, Vitelli, you're just taking us forward. How? How are you doing this? What are you doing?
It's basic application where you build, you know, specialize the systems based on what's called a augmented, basically the big models, and you can augment the local data. And it's available out of the box from just all the major providers. It's just a matter of building an API and knowing how to use the basic programming. Here we go. You can.
It's great.
One thing I'd like to make sure that I put this message across. A system does not replace the master.
True.
Mm-hmm. It's an assistant.
True.
So that's so basically, I'd like to caution everybody who wants to take this part, right? Because in the end, we're serving the human. In the end, we're serving the customer. And assistance is wonderful. But if you delegate everything to assistants, you pretty much will probably piss off your customers out. They want to work. They want to ask to the. They want to work at the shop owner, not the system. So that's the balance that we really need to keep an eye on. It's way too easy nowadays to delegate everything to those systems. Mm-hmm. That's what we should be watching.
Yeah, good point. Yes, sir.
I'm putting Stafford as the director of IT. So just a couple of reflections on both points. I think one thing that you mentioned earlier, a few minutes ago, I think the way to look at AI is, at least at this point in time, is not for independent decision making. Right? It has to augment a workflow for a decision. If we go about it that way, like what we have deployed is across our primary care, you know, we are presenting draft responses to our PCPs for my health messages coming in from the patients. So every message is still reviewed and potentially edited by a clinician before it goes out. Can't let it run solo for the reasons that everybody knows. And I think just a quick reflection on education, there are a number of institutions, I did it from MIT, they have like quick 6-week courses for IT execs healthcare execs
good.
On AI and healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about the fundamentals, and it's sort of a mental course, you know, it's a part-time thing. But they present some very interesting, very varied use cases that have been deployed, so that it kind of opens up your mind as to, okay, you know, what kind of problems AI can solve.
Perfect.
And again, just double underlining the fact that let the problem define the solution. The solution might not even be AI. I mean, you know, in the past month, I've had three use cases on my desk. Two of them didn't even end up needing AI. We just had to clean up an extract or two, you know, to present cleaner data to coders, rather than, but it came in as, oh, we want AI so that we can.
Don't you like when your consumers tell you how to fix the problem?
It's usually the way it works. They come to you with the solution, and then you have to figure out what the problem was.
Yeah, the AI all plastered all over it, but the person who actually was dealing with the issue, they were having to like manually transcribe information across the system, so we just cleaned up a data extract that was feeding into the solution.
Yep.
Right.
No, that's smart. I mean, the education, there's been a lot of courses. There's starting to see, you know, books published for dummies. It's great. I love those books. They're awesome. They're quick reads. You know, if you can, if your organization can, you know, bring somebody in-house and do a workshop for a day as a group session, so that as you start to build the awareness to your point on education, I think that's definitely a key takeaway. And that helps them start to think about the business a little bit. So, you know, when you look at AI, I was just curious, you know, everybody's been using it. Amazon's been doing it since, what, 1990, okay? And I was just curious, so what are the things they've been forcing us to use? Customer recommendations, obviously we all fall into that. Supply chain optimization, okay? Warehouse robotics. Alexa, it's all AI-driven, okay? Amazon Web Service, we're living it every day. Fraud detection, which is great. That's some of the things you talked about. Customer service and product search and discovery. So some of those concepts, though, are very applicable to the clinical, especially in the warehouse section.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think that's when you start getting people to think a little bit outside the box and show how you can really optimize the use of this technology. So
this is actually a wonderful point. One way you can paint the picture for somebody else why you would use it is to use other examples.
Absolutely.
And my favorite, my absolute favorite, that kind of people don't quite think about it, but you know that Amazon can now deliver things to you like matter of hours.
True.
That's because they can predict how many people will buy this thing here tomorrow.
Right.
That's what it is. Think about it. It's they done it. And this is something, if you do it in a lab environment, you will be light years. Well, you're not going to be light years. You'll be up to the point in 2020,
right?
You'll be out of the dark ages. But other people have been doing it.
Right. Where is that AI saying, patient who just showed up in clinic did not have A, B, C, D, and tests done, and so they don't leave the clinic, and you call them up, so you better come back. You know at the point of service that they've got outstanding work that you should do. And you say, hey, would you mind if we do this other testing so you don't have to come back? Right?
You'll know that you need to use specific instruments, specific reagents. You'll need to know, basically, you can know what kind of CPT codes you'll submit to which payer. You know what this payer requires for the patient. You will know when and what the payer is to take the diagnosis. You know that additional documentation will be required to actually get paid, so you know all of it up front. All of it, just by the time the patient shows up at the door with the diagnosis, before you draw the blood. You know which location you need to give the blood, you know you can schedule the delivery of it like Amazon does. You can do all that today with all the tools available if you are in the best.
Right. We just have to we have to cobble them together.
Organizations, go ahead, please. No, sure.
I think the other important aspect of AI is you know, you can have a great algorithm. You've got to be careful where it points to. The data set that you're looking at is very critical. You know, in software engineering, they say garbage in is garbage out, right? Everybody knows that. So AI is learning from a database. You've got to make sure it's clean. You make sure it's the right data set, complete, right? Otherwise, you're going to get garbage out.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in some ways, this is why financials are a little easier to work because we work hard to have them clean. So if that's your clean data set, mm-hmm. now you can see your outliers more readily. Yes?
One of the very important aspects of AI-related projects is these are not your typical traditional rollouts that you just take live and just walk away from. It's a different way of leaning into a technology. There has to be constant monitoring
mm-hmm.
and tuning of the data sets. And that's a new muscle memory that most IT organizations and most organizations
yeah.
all have to do. So that's why being cautious and again having like you know what we term as okay, you know, we look at your best practice alerts every year or if at a certain frequency are they being effective or not, are people overriding those in the same way, depending on the use case, you know, AI, the model that you deploy, whatever solution you deploy has to be possible. It's different from
how. Yeah, and I think that goes to your point. From your organization, having the data office provide you information that you can trust, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I want to piggyback on. So you guys want to talk about cyber risk assessments, right? So, like,
mm-hmm.
so I think it's not just having cybersecurity analysts, cybersecurity operations folks, but also on the intake side. So as you're introducing novel technologies, be it software or hardware, into your enterprise architecture, you need to ensure that you have proper vetting of that information. So you need a cyber risk governance officer and team to create a threat assessment formulary that the enterprise will adopt. And if that formulary has failed, that software or hardware is not going to be implemented or installed.
Mm-hmm.
Period. Right? Mm-hmm. So you need to have that as your backstop. Hey, you guys did not pass the cyber risk assessment. You guys are storing data in Manila. We won't allow that, you know, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's also part of that maturity, working in conjunction with IT. They're not necessarily part of IT, but they're, you know, parallel to IT.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So just part of like a mature organization making proper assessments for the PHI.
How many other people are dealing with that problem right now? The information privacy, security, validation. I must have at least 20 emails in my inbox right now about 6 different projects that we're just trying to stand up, one of which is a digital scanner that has no PHI in it at all. And yet the information privacy security office has taken us over the barrel to try to understand what this technology is. So having a mature relationship with this cybersecurity, your information privacy and security office is absolutely essential in getting them educated so that you don't have to re-explain every time you go around the loop what it is you're up to. Anybody else struggling with that problem in their environment?
It's not a struggle, but it's more of an observation that, again, this is a new way of doing things, and there are rules that you need to understand. Say, for example, right now we are deploying a peripheral artery disease model in my cardiovascular health side of the shop, which gives a score around this patient might have had. And essentially, we have to go to privacy to check, because what we're doing is the system model is presenting a score inside a patient test in APEC. And then based on that, an NP is doing a sanity check, and then they're communicating with the PCP. Now, the communication with the PCP is an intra-epic communication between them. That said, you need to check in with like the likes of privacy to see, okay, before the PCP has reached out to the patient and the patient has consented to this, is it okay to document something on the patient's chart or not? Because this is, again, trying to do something early enough, proactively, but then again, there are rules that HIMSS and privacy are going to come in and want to chime in on whether you can proactively document on a chart or not, or do you have to keep it outside in terms of things like that.
Interesting.
It's a small example.
Interesting.
But there is finesse in terms of, you know, what you can or cannot do and understanding boundaries that you might not have touched earlier.
Doesn't the military have an expression, you're building the bridge while you're crossing the river or something? That's exactly what we're doing. We're writing all these rules and security and everything as we're doing all of this stuff.
Yeah.
I want to fly the plane as
we do. There you go.
Well, and the whole game has changed, right? I mean, it used to be that you could run antivirus software with antivirus definitions and just keep them up to date. Now we have zero threat actors, right? You don't have time to use definitions. So it's actually all driven by AI, right? You're looking at the CPU of the computer and say, what just got kicked off and why? Well, I don't know about you. I have had some of that software squash completely basic lab operations and runs of lab tests have not gone out the interface. Because something was detected as an unusual activity. Yeah, it's called, we just generated 10,000 lab tests, and you just noticed, and so it shut it off. So this becomes a friction. I mean, there's about, my gut tells me there's about 10 to 20% friction going on in our labs right now just to keep current with the security requirements, both on the intake side for new technology, on the outtake side for keeping that technology safe. How do we keep it safe? Shall it be in front of a firewall? Shall it have a microsegmentation of the LAN? Are those good enough for this person? Now the FDA comes in and says you can't use microsegmentation because the FDA contract says it must use Fortinet. Thank you very much for making my job harder. So this little security world bit is a real consumer of our healthcare dollar. I remember when I got to Henry Ford, there was no information privacy and security officer office. There was a chief security officer. Now I think there's 70 or 80 people in that group. And so when you got 70 or 80 people, what do? They have to find things to do. All right, look, we're just about a minute before our planned bio break. Let me just check. Is everybody hearing okay when people are talking in the room? I'm looking at the guys in the back and in the middle. Great. So I kind of like this format. Again, this is growing organically. I think we just took a long, deep dive down the AI rabbit hole.
Sure did. Yeah.
So maybe what we'll do is we'll break. Let's come back and we'll try to unveil maybe a couple of other topics that people would be interested in and want to hear more from you for what your solutions have been. I'm thinking specifically around some things like digital pathology or deploying analytics. So put your thinking caps on, and we'll come back, and we'll start again at 3:45.
Correct.
Correct?
Yep, that's
all right.
Exactly. Perfect.
All right, well, why don't we go ahead and get started? I figured we'd have a little attrition with a break. In fact, I said to Robert last time, let's take the break and just make the session 70 minutes. Yeah, okay.
I don't know who all came back, but I have a feeling that my problems, my things that keep getting better are different than other people, largely just because Gravity Diagnostics is a much smaller entity organization than I think a lot of people are. It was kind of
talk through what the use cases are.
My IT organization is 10. And half of that is because so there's no really, like, information security professionals. You've got like two LIS administrators, two infrastructure guys, and that's the team. So the things that keep me up at night are probably a lot different. But on my side, like one of the biggest things that I have is balancing systems within budget because of the small nature of the organization. So it's the lab has their defined workflow, and that workflow works for them because that's how they get it accomplished to meet turnaround time and to meet the expectation of the clients, which is very important, and that's how it has to work. Because without that expectation, you can piss off your clients and lose the business and this type of thing. But in a lot of instances, that means that sometimes we have to then say, okay, well then your infrastructure is going to cost twice as much because it's going to do nothing 75% of the day, but 25% of the day you're releasing every single sample that you possibly could release, and it just overwhelms the system.
Yes, so capacity is episodic, right?
You designed your workflow in a batch process, which means that you're releasing 10,000 samples in 5 minutes and then nothing for the next 55 minutes.
Now, even though we're a lot bigger organization, We've been looking recently at the use of our microtomy stations because we've got 15 of them crammed into a very small space, and they're used every day, but there are times of the day when some of them fall fallow. So can we, because of ergonomics, rip out a few of those microtomy stations and somehow figure out how to balance the load across them? And you know, the challenge we all face is that if you build for your maximum capacity, and that only happens once a day, that means, you know, three other times of the day, you're at zero, right? Everyone's gone. And so it becomes very expensive to handle those capacity issues.
And I'm not even talking about instrument side. I'm talking about purely server side as well. Like, a lot of the lab space in the LIS, the LIMS, those things, a lot of them are antiquated Cisco database software. Our LIMS database runs on a 40 database. That's from 1970s. So, I mean, trying to process thousands upon thousands of results out of a 4D database can cripple it.
I'd like to ask you a question. Jeff McLean from Moffitt. In my former life, I was a histotech, okay? Not the administrator. So if you, every lab I've ever seen on the AP side, the IT partners with the histology manager and that, and then trying to get them to not do things in big batches, try to continuous flow, and they have to re-engineer their entire, you know, their process. So, what is your relationship with, like, with your histology manager?
So we're not on the pathology side; we're actually toxicology, but okay. Still
what kind of lab? And
still the same lines, though. Yeah. I mean, it's that they have a workflow that works, and so you've got your toxicology manager, and it's the same issue. Is that whether it's pathology or toxicology, you have to redesign your workflow to work in smaller batches. Because the way they have built it over 7 years is this workflow works because we can do all of our reviews on all of our specimens, and then that takes us an hour, and then we release.
So it works for them, but it doesn't work for the organization. And that's why you have to find your partners and just say, look, this is great for you, but you're causing a mess in. So I tend to try to build relationships outside the department with other support service areas and try to get them to understand, you know, the organizational impacts. I can get your contact and maybe give you some ideas.
I think that, and that's where I think we run into some of the problems as well, is being a small organization, a small company. There are a few key people that hold all those chips, hold all that power. We have convinced many of people, even people that are above those people, to have the chips. Like, there's one person that holds most of the chips that reports to somebody we've convinced, but because they hold the chips and they've been with the company since it's founded, even if they aren't C-suite or anything like that, they can go to the CEO, the founder, and say, I want my way, and they get their money.
So then, you know, I found the strategy is to turn to the customer side, right? Because if you're disappointing your customer, all of a sudden, that guy in the C-suite starts to get more interested. Although it's not always the case. It's good enough, you know. We make enough hamburgers and we get enough money, it's all good. But that's really what changes that equation in a situation like that. In my experience, the customers, look, we're not happy with our service. There's many ways you could address that if people gave you new analyzers, new lab information systems, new workflow, conveyance systems. I mean, there's all sorts of ways to level the load, to use lean speed. But if you're not getting the support to do that, where does it come from? Well, usually it comes from a frustrated end user or someone who's important to your organization. And so for us, in a larger organization, we're part of the food chain, that's ticking off the surgeons in the operating room or ticking off the GI surgeons in the outpatient settings because our turnaround time has decayed so badly in histology because we can't hire histotechs. Our turnaround times are 4 days on biopsies, which is just, you know, hey, it doesn't mean to your organization, but for the rest of you, you know, in the room that live in that heterogeneous hospital environment, to me, the customer is always what you want. In fact, that's what the answer to me to AI is. It's like, what does the customer really want? And if that surgeon really wants an assay that's going to identify the appropriate infiltrating lymphocytes, you know, using PD-L1, that's what's going to bring that assay in. Because if you just build and say, hey, we got PD-L1 by AI for you, who cares? Right? So maybe let's maybe try to shift to your question. Do you want to restate what you asked us at the break?
Yeah, sure. So just the role of the CIO in the process of making decisions in the lab, right? When I look at other care areas in the hospital, CMI or CIO is much more engaged in the front end of the process in all the decisions and workflows in cardiology, OR, etc. Right? The lab, I mean, I've spoken to a few customers like that, right? Very few IT folks get involved early in the process. So just from a best, we talked about best practices earlier, what is your recommendation in the room? You've got thoughts about how does IT engage in the lab process up front earlier, regardless of what they are buying or what they implement, right?
Right. Well, I mean, my first reaction is be careful what you ask for. Because you may just run into absolute obstruction. Well, why do you want to do that? You know, it kind of alludes to my whining about having to go through all the security validations and clearances. By the way, I think is absolutely essential. On the other hand, I shouldn't have to be justifying to an individual why we can't put a VLAN in front of a Roche piece of equipment because Roche's contract says we can't do that, right? So how do you engage with the information technology team effectively, I think, is kind of the substance of your question. So my approach has always been to be proactive and to try to set what the appropriate boundaries are. One of the things that's happening to us recently is the organization has decided that anything IT must have a project manager. Okay, anything. IT must have a project manager. And then the next email is, but we don't have enough project managers, so you will be delayed. And so our approach has always been, we don't need a project manager to implement an instrument, right? We don't need a project manager to replace the new PCs for the pathologists. We might need a project manager to stand up an automated chemistry line that's going to require 30 servers, firewall work, so forth and so on. And actually, it's probably more the facility side of it than anything else. So I think what I've tried to do is to figure out where's IT going to help? Where are they going to obstruct? How do we educate them to understand why they would help and why they don't need to waste their resources on small little things? And you know, actually the most recent one is the project manager found out that he wasn't invited to be part of the project, so now he's writing the people who are doing the project saying, hey, you don't have a project manager. And we're saying, yeah, we're doing just fine.
We're almost done.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you very much. Yes?
So on that end, so communication, we actually have industry relationship managers in IT, and those are the ones that we work on IT strategic roadmaps with. From everything from, so like an instrument would be keeping the lights on, right, ETLO, versus like a larger net new technology implementations. And so we define those in the strategic roadmap, instrumentation versus other projects, and then also we do something called t-shirt sizing, right? So
say that word again.
T-shirt sizing. So extra small, medium, large, extra large.
Good.
And so the way we define it is extra small can be done just by the IT lab team with no PM. And if it's medium or larger, we need a PM. And then it has to go, then we need the EPMO, the Enterprise Project Management Office, to let us know when the PM will be available. And then we put that in our roadmap accordingly, right? And so we try as best as we can to try to do small, extra small, as best as we can. But the moment we start getting 3, 4, 5 teams involved, then you need a PM.
I know, and I hate to use LabCorp, but you know, we formed a project review committee, and everything had to go to the committee. And if you didn't have a proxy representing IT, that's a problem. Okay, and sometimes you may have to sit through a review committee that has nothing to do with IT, but at least we tell people, well, you can't say you didn't know about it, okay? And I think you have to establish that discipline a little bit to make sure that people are well informed and they can't come back and say, well, we didn't know about this, and then they become the obstructionist, okay? And I think that's where you got to really, committees aren't always the best, but if you let the executive leader in IT send a proxy, make sure they're represented, at least they can come back and you take notes and you publish that. There's no excuse anymore.
I like that. The key influences of the process, they might might not be the decision maker, but the
other right. Yeah, but, you know, there's things that affect the organization, to Mark's point, that, you know, maybe that doesn't affect IT, but maybe it does indirectly through, because they structured it where customer support is going through IT for whatever reason. You don't know, because organizations structure things a little bit different. And so that those project review committees are extremely effective. And if it doesn't have that approval, it doesn't get done.
I've got a perfect example for you. Like, it's projects that may not affect IT, but a FYI is all it is.
That's all it is.
Like,
I agree.
Facilities decides, hey, we're closed on President's Day, so let's do maintenance on our power grid. IT doesn't know, but all of a sudden we get the entire team woken up at 5 in the morning of all your servers.
And the generator goes off and there's no fuel.
Because we didn't know that they were doing that. If we had known about it, we would have said, okay, we are aware that 5 a.m.
Good example.
Servers are all going to go off. We're going to get notifications. It should be back up 2 hours
later. Perfect example. I mean, and, you know, in our committee, we publish notes, and they got distributed to the organization. So there's no excuse. If you can't go and you need to go, send a proxy. That's just the rule. So those are effective.
And I love the comment about right sizing or T-shirt sizing, because there are projects that are small, and there's a lot of variations of this. So, for example, we negotiated with IT. And by the way, our informatics group looks at ourselves as a peninsula of IT. We don't look at ourselves as an island, right? We work with them. We communicate with them. We communicate week in, week out. But because of that communication, one of the things we've done is we've created a lot of capital, right? Because they trust us and they know what we can do. So we negotiated for projects that did not impact the EMR that could occur even though there was an EMR no-fly zone. Does everyone know what I mean by that?
Yeah, we call it a freeze.
Okay, yeah, an IT freeze or no-fly. I mean, there's all sorts of terms for it. But the bottom line is to say you can't do anything between this day and that day. Well, sometimes that's 6 weeks, right? And you're paralyzed. And we're making routine changes to lab test codes. It's got nothing to do with what's happening with the IT system. And so one of the things we did is we negotiated with IT to have what we call a standard lab change. That was the words we used. Mm-hmm. And that means that we can operate within that no-fly zone. Oh, my God. The bandwidth that that created for our IT lab-related IT project groups is inestimable. And prior to that, it was a real challenge. So, you know, the other thing to recognize is this is kind of a pendulum, right? It swings back and forth. And right now, there's a whole bunch of new PMs and a whole bunch of new security folks at Henry Ford. So I realized last week, we need to go back to the educational table. Because 5 years ago, we sat down with the privacy team. We said, hey, if we're going to work with you, we need to have one point of contact. You can't send us a new naive security person every time we have a new lab project because we have to do all that re-education. And actually, that's what's been happening lately. That's what's happening with the project management office. They have forgotten about our T-shirt sizing approach to things where we do not need them to stand up new servers. We do that all the time. When we have to stand up a new 100 gigabit network and add, you know, a petabyte of storage to the network, that's a different problem. So guess what? For 10 years, I've been saying, we will have 100 GBS requirements. We will have petabyte level storage requirements. This is coming at us. Every year, I'd say that. So 3 months ago, it happened. And the IT team didn't even blink. They just pulled the switches out of the closet and hooked them up, and then they had to go to someone with the capital to say, hey, wait a minute, we need to actually put this new switch in that's going to cost $380,000. And that's the only roadblock. IT was prepared for that. So it went immediately through stage gate, no hassles for justification. Yes, there's a hassle for the capital.
So our IT won't even allow us to put something on the roadmap unless it's been forecasted. Like the budget piece.
Mm-hmm.
So that's so upfront. Not trying to find the $300,000 after the fact. You need to tell IT that you have the $300,000 and then you can go.
Interesting. Yeah. So in this particular instance, These were two devices that somehow arrived on campus without the appropriate planning. And guess what? The person who got them to arrive is a few levels above my pay grade, and I'm not allowed to say I told you so. But I can say, I think that's going to be at least 120 to 500 days before you have what you need to do your operational work. And this is not happy news for multi-million-dollar investments with molecular technology. So this is part of my molecular technology flippy-floppy monkey business that's constantly going on. You guys must see it at Moffitt all the time.
Yeah, part of the challenge that you're also talking about is working with your practice administrator in your department. It could be your DA, your administrator, whoever, makes agreements with chairs, vice chairs, medical directors in the recruiting process, promises them that you're going to get XYZ piece of equipment, a lab, and this and that. They don't tell anybody. The pathology person shows up day one, and it's like, okay, you know, where's my equipment? Where's my this? Where's my scanner? Right? So you have to, like, connect with the practice piece, the recruiting piece.
Right, right. I mean, that sounds like a classic research organization problem, right? Anybody else in here come from a research organization? Okay, so you know, oh, yeah, from Stanford, so yeah. So how do you address that at Stanford?
The brand name in the offer letter? Wow.
In the offer letter.
Yeah.
Interesting. And did that happen?
Yeah.
It did happen.
Wow, but
so how was that communicated in the department so that the appropriate capital came to bear, the IT was ready? I mean, we have enough trouble getting a microscope on someone's desk.
I mean, the CEO themselves were first invested in this situation. This is not the norm. So the norm is that we have a governance around, so we can call it different names, but there's a governance that we have. So for what we categorize as project is anything over $100. And it not even if you cross that threshold, it doesn't have to be assigned to a project manager. Right, going back to the point that you're making. We make that assertion. So I sat down with the chief of pathology, the administrator, every quarter we look and we project for the next quarter. And all the demands coming in from the lab, they all get discussed. We go through them, we rank them, we agree with them, and we do follow a similar concept that if something, we normally do and sit and do an annual planning together, but if something comes outside of that planning because things can change, one of the things can break down. So if that were to happen, then we do expect that the department would come in with funding so that we can move forward as quickly as possible. So our processes have matured over a period of time. We do have, you know, we ran through all the issues that you guys described. We went through flavors of those, but now we don't because of these open lines of communication, very important. And again, the lens that I maintain with my functions and I oversee lab, pharmacy, cardiovascular health, and inpatient, you know, in my past life. So what that means is they have the keys. IT doesn't decide what we work on. We let them decide what IT should work on. IT is an extension of their organization and is meant to support that function. So, but again, my rule is that, okay, you know, you're going to tell us what we work on, but then if somebody has to hear to know, it's not going to be me or my team that goes and says, no, you're going to go ahead.
Anybody else have challenges with project management in the number? Anybody have too few projects to work on in your board to have extra analysts? Good, we got a laugh out of that one. Yeah, exactly. You know, every time you turn around, there's five more informatics projects. In fact, one of the things we did when I really early arrived at my place is we went through all the projects and we said, well, which one of these projects actually needs informatics or IT? And you know what the answer was? Every one of them. You know? So we stopped that exercise pretty quickly and we started to say, how much informatics and IT do they need and who can own that? And could we get help from IT? Anybody tried to get IT to help support the laboratory printers in their hospital? You do?
Yeah.
That's a great story. How do you do that, Jim?
I think it's related. relationships, really. You know, really, all of this stuff is every bit of this is knowing how to, you know, horse trade and building trust, building rapport. That's how you get things done.
Right.
It's more about the people than anything else.
Interesting. So talk about analytics. The reason I'm on this little printer thing is because we looked at the number of tickets we were getting, and the number one ticket was broken printers, one way or the other. Bad labels, wards, intralab, outreach sites sending stuff. And if you looked across all of our tickets, it was the number one ticket that we have day in, day out, week in, week out. And we would go to IT and say, help, help, help. They said, oh, no, we don't support printers. We don't support printers. So the latest strategy was we got three agency people to come in and support printers at very expensive costs. And it all went into an IT cost center. Okay? And so IT realized, oh, my God, we just spent $240,000 supporting printers with agency staff. We really should have a team, to your point. But we couldn't get it through the political capital because no one wanted that dirt pile, right? No one wanted the dirt pile of the broken printer. It's a hassle. I mean, AI ain't going to fix that as far as I can tell. Maybe it will change the cartridge. It could tell you it's going to die. I suppose there is that. So, you know, that's a really interesting strategy. But for us, that didn't work. We had to actually go fund it through another mechanism that was not a good mechanism. But what it really showed was that this was a real problem, and we could either hire a team that we ran day-to-day, like phlebotomy, right? It's analogous sort of a problem, supporting printers and having phlebotomists. And then we could turn that around and say, this would cost us half this amount of money, and we could do a better job if we actually funded what we're trying to do appropriately.
Now, if it's a good IT department, they'll say, we're going to save money, we're going to cut the budget in half. They'll take credit for the three, you know, the money you spent by cutting it, right?
Right, instead of taking credit for the printers that actually
That's
worked.
Right, yeah. So.
And by the way, why are we fixing printers? Because we have 250 label defects in the core lab. I'm just focusing on core lab. 250 no-read label defects every day in the core lab, and if you look at the cost of that to run them down, we're doing 15,000 tubes, so it's actually not a bad ratio. The problem is 250 broken labels a day equals about $250,000 worth of rework by lab, phone calls, relabeling, blah, blah, blah. So it's the upstream cost of that, and not to mention the frustration of the nursing units because it falls back to them because their sample couldn't get run. Blah, blah, blah. And by the way, that's the 250 that were purely hardware. I'm not talking about the other 250 that was a bad order or something else was screwed up with the communication. So this is, you know, the brass tacks of how do you get this work done.
You know what I've done in my career? If there's a problem that's pesky, nobody wants to touch it, just start filling out safety reports and get it to risk. Because they will get somebody to spend the money on whatever it is. So 250 specimens a day times 365 days is that many chances for a lawsuit, misdiagnosis, and so on. So we've done that with courier issues. They wouldn't hire enough couriers. Fill out a safety report. We'll create a mountain of safety reports to the point where it's just like, please stop filling out safety reports. So you go to your risk management. That's another way.
It's a good idea.
Yeah, great idea. And that actually works for a lot of problems, sure, right? Yeah. It's the printer, it's the courier, it's the lack of complete orders being entered into the EMR, lack of ICD-9 or 10 codes. I dated myself because that problem was an ICD-9 problem, but we fixed it with safety reports.
And that's a compliance issue because they have to address it now.
What happens
it won't go away.
You put in that safety report from IT and the risk management people is IT.
Okay, there's a sage takeaway from this session today. It's time to get a new job, yeah? That goes through my mind at least twice a day. Really.
I kind of throw the fire on the oil right now. How do you think Amazon or Google or Apple would solve the problem? How would they sell devices every day, I think.
Yeah, I think they print money. So they throw money at it. I mean, that's my reaction, Vitaly. I mean, it's like, you know, the way the supply chain works there, it just is not what's happened in the lab, and it's really kind of scary to me. It's like we get a sample sent at us, and we just hope it shows up. Anybody else in that situation? Who has complete end-to-end sample tracking chain of custody? It's on your wish list. It's on our wish list.
It's
too.
A permanent wish list, right?
Yeah.
We've got samples of rock bands, like Vegas rolls in here. Yeah. We've got, like, you know, tubes of blood rolling around the floor of a courier car. I know examples of people, you know, in, like, New York. You know, the courier stops at the bar, you know, on the way. There's turnaround times. So you can't tell where your sample is until it enters the lab. Like, not everybody has that true end-to-end tracking.
Yeah. And it has been wishlisted just about every lab for 10 years.
We brought FedEx in, and we couldn't solve it.
But I think to the Amazon and Google, they would engineer the process to make it ridiculously easy to fix or replace the unit. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So how come we can do that?
Profitability? Storage capacity?
Sorry, lack of profitability. Right. For Amazon, it's profitable. For healthcare organizations, it's not.
Yeah.
That's exactly the point. And again, the answer varies. So in our zip code, I mean, we have like 7,000 printers, you know, and it's very easy to, I mean, previously it was the nurses, you know, who were trained to replace the cartridges and all, but like somebody has to PM, somebody has to go and fix the ones that are broken. So what where we ended up being is like, okay, because we are in one of the most expensive zip codes in the country, Palo Alto. So you know, like it didn't make sense to hire MPs to do that. So there are companies like Rico and others that
yes.
services. People sell printers like outside healthcare and say, how do we solve this problem, right? So that's what keeps kind of
their specialists, they come in, they take care of things, and again at the end of the day, it's a matter of
right, and we did the same thing. We have a microcomputer support service that we've hired to do some of that printer support, but they wouldn't let him come inpatient.
Right.
They wouldn't let him get him into the lab. They would do our outreach and our outpatient pretty well, but you know they set up barriers. But you're right, contract the service, I think, is what I'm hearing you say.
So that's what keeps me in mind. Basically, how come you know people in other industries can do things really efficiently? What's up with us? Why is it?
Yeah.
I mean, they have scale. People sell printers every day, right? So that's somehow they do it. And for us, and I hear the stories. I mean, I'm very close to them. I mean, we have lots of printers. It's a real problem. How come we cannot be like Google or Amazon? How come?
Yeah.
See, the hospital systems are in the business of healthcare, and they're not in the business of IT. They're not in the business of hardware.
Right.
So they're more like consumers. So I think it's a slightly different hat than me. I came from big tech. I came from IT. I was an executive for 9 years. I've worked with all these big techs. So it's a different lens of looking at things. I mean, hospital systems, unless you're like a massive one with unlimited pockets, you know, this is not your core business. Your
right. But we all know in the lab, it starts with a label, right?
We've been looking at the cost effectiveness of using RFID labels.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it's, and that works well from a tracking standpoint when you're talking about a reference lab, because you're trying to then get that RFID tracking to be able to see it on a UPS truck or a FedEx facility, where it's different than a hospital, where it's going down the hall.
Mm-hmm.
You actually need to be able to see it outside of the building on the courier truck and something.
What's the cost of implementation for RFID?
That's where it comes down to the cost effectiveness.
Yeah. So we've placed them in different places.
When you're talking about an RFID embedded label where there's a chip in every single label, you're talking now 10 cents a label, 15 cents a label.
Yeah.
So the cost dramatically increases, and not to mention the fact that you need a specialized printer. The longer you can get the Sados or the Dymos off the Walmart shelf, you need to get a $1,000 printer direct from the manufacturer.
Mm-hmm. So our approach has been to barcode RFID big things. So we RFID coolers, but we don't RFID the bags that the bags are in. So the big parent is the cooler, but bag that's got tubes in it, they're all done by linear barcodes. But we do track them now, because what we did is when we contracted with our courier, we said, you will need to read our barcodes to courier our samples. And so now when they collect, they ping our barcodes and we can see what's in their truck. Now, we don't know what it is without going back and looking in the LIS quite yet. That's the next phase of the project, is to make that connection. But we at least know what's on a truck, and we know what got taken off a truck, and we know if the stuff didn't make it back from the bar on Saturday night. And we also know that the truck went over there and did some things for a while before actually coming to its route or skipped its route. So transparency in couriering is a really valuable effort for a laboratory in our experience. We've actually saved hundreds of hours in chasing samples, not to mention all of the negative impact on patient care and patient service.
Courier uses the barcode you give them?
Yes. So the courier pings our barcode, and that's what shows up in their system.
So it sounds like we're pivoting this topic to futures.
There you go. Yeah, let's do it.
Is anybody delivering or sending specimens by drone? Is that something that Joshua and I have been talking about, from location to location?
We certainly are not. We're not even using autonomous rovers or robots, which, by the way, I have read a lot about. There is a wide deployment of them around the world, usually bigger labs, Japan, maybe some labs in the U.S. I can't remember where this last article I read was, but it was a U.S. lab. It may have been UCLA.
Discussion in this room at 7:30 this morning.
There you go.
Really?
Okay. Who was that? Do you remember?
Doesn't Europe do something like that?
I can't remember the company.
Aethon is a company that does
robotics. Yeah, it was the Aethon Thugs, what they were using now, but they had used the things before that.
Yeah. Right.
They had effectively renamed their rover Rosie.
Yes.
So not drones yet. No drones for us. Yeah, I think they might get shot down in Detroit.
Maybe next year's EWC will present on whether we have.
And so, what would your application be?
So we have we just opened a 20 OR expansion hospital with 200 beds. It's a mile away. We only have 10,000 square feet in that new hospital, right? And they said, okay, you need a frozen room that can handle 20 ORs. You need a full service blood bank. You need enough CP that you can get the majority of the tests done, and then we also put in a research suite so that we can allocate tissues for clinical trials. 10,000 square feet, go. And we crammed it all in. So, but the issue is, we figured out solutions for everything, except we only have so many analyzers in the clinical lab. If everything else has to go 1 mile away to the big lab, how can we get that done faster? And then we were thinking, there are drone systems that will literally, you just put them on a GPS track, put the specimens in it, and it just literally flies a mile, and then has its little landing thing. And
then we have satellite campuses within a 35-mile radius. So the thought is, we're actually, in January of 2025, we opened a satellite campus south of us. In January 2026, we opened a satellite campus north of us. So, in addition to the existing satellite campuses, and those satellite campuses have CP because we're doing phlebotomy, infusion, right? And so, minimal CP footprint at those campuses, and then stuff needs to go to the big lab, right? So, it could be Tampa traffic is getting crazy, so.
I'm going to say, you got traffic too.
Yeah, so instead of doing 45 minutes an hour for a specimen, can we have a direct line of sight through with a drone, right? There's practical use cases, and so I'm glad Jim asked the question. It doesn't sound like anybody here is using it. So
the only thing I would say, this was a couple of years ago, but I would be double checking FAA regulations on it as well, because I know at one point a couple of years ago I read that yes, you could run drones commercially, but you had to have a legitimate credentialed pilot, and it had to be in line of sight at all times.
Well, this would be autonomous, is my understanding.
Well, that's what I'm saying, is I would be checking the applicable regulation on it, because the FAA might just shut you down before it even starts.
Yeah. Our compliance office may shut us down.
I think it's a great thing to think about, you know. And so, you know, obviously courier would meet your need, but it's going to have a traffic problem. Tube is too far and requires digging.
And you have traffic too. I mean, not traffic, weather.
Well, also, like, going, you know, our hospital is within 5 miles of an airport. So, you know, so there are FAA regulations that you can't be flying drones if you're within a certain So you have.
We're lucky on that side, like, we're on the opposite side of town from the airport. So,
so it wouldn't be restricted airspace. It would be more along the lines of, do you need to have an authorized person actually manning it? Mm-hmm. Do they have to be in line of sight? Can you do it autonomously?
Yeah.
Like,
can I hire some teenager to do it?
Hey, my grandson has his drone pilot. He's in Tampa. Yes, ma'am.
But Tampa General actually just did something for the emergency services in Manatee County, where they're using drones and a 3.5-mile radius to take equipment. So I was like, did I imagine that? I mean, they did start doing it. I don't know how it's going. It just started last week or this week.
Is that under the cancer center or on the acute care side?
It's acute. It's emergency care.
Okay, emergency care. You said that. Sorry. Okay, all
right. I'm in Manatee County because apparently we need to grow all over the state.
You guys have been poaching for months.
It's crazy. I know. It's crazy.
I'm from Tampa, too, and I saw that article.
Oh!
I can say, it sounds like you guys got people to collaborate with. Hey, we accomplished our mission.
I think we more than accomplished it.
5,000 miles to know that somebody's 5 miles radius.
And so, you know, obviously you've got sample integrity issues. You probably have got, you know, regulatory issues, maybe not only FAA, but I'm not sure what the CAP has to say about it. You know, and then you've got your challenges with chain of custody still, right? What happens if your drone crashes? You know, interesting question. So we'll look forward to hearing about it. Right. I wasn't joking about Detroit. People shoot down drones. It's like a game.
Wow.
You fly your drone around the neighborhood, someone says, hey, you got a drone! You know, it's like open season, believe it or not. And in theory, you're not supposed to be doing that in certain areas, right? I don't know what the rules are in Michigan specifically. So this has really been so interactive, and thanks to you for staying with us. Anybody have anything else out there that's kind of burning on them that we haven't talked about? Completely different topic. Jim.
I have something that's obscure.
Please.
And this is, I've been thinking a lot about this, is with the way things are, socio-political, you know, there's a lot of, obviously, conflict in things between the United States, other countries. And I've been thinking lately, like, what would happen in the terms of a terrorist event of an EMP or an energy weapon or something like that, specific to IT or data or chips, right? What would happen if there were a, you know, some type of electromagnetic something, fried every you know, motherboard, every hard drive, not just for like the data warehouse. I'm sure that's all covered in aluminum or who knows.
Whatever. We can dream.
Just to like deflect it.
Yeah, but right.
The analyzers would be cooked. Everything would be cooked. Right. What do we do? And is there anybody talking at a national level for clinical laboratory pathology? What to do if there were such an event, disaster planning?
You certainly have taken business continuity to a much larger level. You know,
I mean, I'm sure that's being talked about at the government level, DOD and stuff like that. From a private industry standpoint, that would be where I would say the conversation that I was in the 1 o'clock hour would come in, where you've got people that are looking at trying to create lab networks beyond Quest and LabCorp, where you've got local labs and regional labs that are in collaboration with each other.
Mm-hmm.
The easiest way to accomplish that would be, hey, an EMP was dropped on Tampa, so every loud in Tampa's hosed, but Miami's good. So,
but is Miami really good?
Well,
sorry.
If Miami's good, Atlanta's good, whatever, but you've got connections, you've got partner labs in other cities that aren't affected that you can start rerouting traffic.
Well, that's called the Academic Medical Center, as far as I can tell, because that's happened. Like when the hurricane hit here and Tulane was shut down, whole bunches of people pitched in to get their samples out. In fact, hardware was donated to them. Where's Clinisys in the room? Because Sunquest really stepped up to the plate, literally delivered brand new servers because their entire server room was flooded. So there is this cooperation. I guess it depends on the scope, right, Jim? I mean, if we're all hosed, my brain said, I don't even think anybody remembers how to do microbiology by biochemicals anymore. So what are we going to do? We don't even have little API scripts around, you know, and never mind if you had to make your own broth. Although we learned that in COVID again.
Yeah, so you are obviously, you know, lecture and present at the, you know, largest LIS type style meetings, not just Executive War College. And is anybody talking about this regionally or nationally, what to do in the case of there's no more IT because everything has been cooked?
I can't say that I've heard anybody take it to the extreme that you have. We have certainly seen and experienced real-time situations where, for example, anybody remember the East Coast power outage in 2003? Okay, so that went all the way from New York to Detroit. We were down for 8 days. Interestingly, most of our IT wasn't down because it was electricity, not fried. You know, so if it's fried, it's a completely different issue. But I think it's probably a conversation that we need to talk about. You're reminding me that the director of the FBI most recently complained that even though he's been warning people about the hacks on our infrastructure grid, no one's paying attention to what he's been saying. And his last article wasn't about that. It was that no one's paying any attention. And I'm going to just go out on a limb and say I think he's probably got a credible point. And so this might be exactly what you're talking about. University of Vermont, 30 days of downage because of ransomware. Everyone know this story, by the way? Oh, go look it up. They actually wrote a 3-page AJCP, I think it's AJCP, article on three separate articles about their 30-day disaster where they were attacked by ransomware and everything went offline. So it wasn't fried, but it was offline. And so what did they do? They were sending stuff to Dartmouth. They were sending stuff across Lake Champlain to Canton-Potsdam. They were sending stuff down to Boston. And meanwhile, they figured out how they could actually do lab testing in a different environment. Their analyzers weren't cooked because analyzers aren't necessarily subject to the ransomware, although some probably were. It's a really interesting case because the other thing about this case, there was no ransom. There was nobody asking for any money. There was no one to pay to undo the code. It was a random malfeasance act. So in other words, someone put the Trojan out there that installed the malware, but no one was actually attached to it to say, and now give us our money and we'll unlock you. So there was no one to even pay. So they were really hosed, kind of like your example almost, Jim.
In Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria in 2017, the Army Corps of Engineers and other folks came in with mobile labs. So, you know, the issue there was no electricity, right? Just no, the entire island, right? Like, my parents didn't have electricity for 5 months. Like, my grandparents, and people forget, the hurricane hit, before Maria, hurricane hit Puerto Rico 2 weeks before.
Right.
And my grandparents didn't have electricity since before that. So, I mean, so they brought in mobile labs, and it was a terrible, terrible time. Like, at least that first month. There's not much. I mean, to your point, the analyzers were there, but there's no juice for them.
Right. So you go to a MASH-style approach, and maybe that's what you're talking about, Jim. You know, maybe there needs to be a capacity to respond to this type of event. Now, who would fund that? I mean, it's probably the military.
And I also, you know, and I think...
For COVID.
Yeah. Is this part of our CIO worries, keeps us awake at night? I worry about it a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's part of my security bit. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I would say, as you're worrying about it, and if you're preparing for it, you need to test the plan, right? Because I think somebody said you're building, you know, you're walking down the bridge that you're building. I think, to your point, anticipating that is probably not a bad idea, and come up with a disaster recovery to test it to see if you can actually do it,
mm-hmm.
right?
So if you have DR...
That's the most important part, is actually testing it.
Yes.
You got to test it.
Off, it's not going to be enough in that season.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, right.
you need to actually put metal to steel and see if it will actually work.
Yep.
And do it for a while, I would say.
Yeah, that test doesn't happen one time. It's a periodic test to make sure that it still works the way you intended. So
when we roll over to DR, we usually sit there for 2 to 3 weeks.
Yep.
Because episodic testing that it works and fails over is one thing, but knowing that it's got the capacity to run for a month is a completely different part of the story.
Good point.
So, you know, one of the interesting things about our DR, and this goes all the way back to that blackout, is that when we built our next DR plan after the blackout, the data center, the secondary data center, and we have a secondary data center, mm-hmm. thanks to Epic's requirements, mm-hmm. by the way, that's an Epic requirement if you want to go up on Epic, is on a completely different electrical grid than the rest of Southeast Michigan. It actually comes in from northern Canada. So that we can be completely out, and as long as no one's cut across Lake Huron, we're probably going to be okay. But it doesn't mean anything if you don't test it.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, so you have to do this failover testing. Does anybody have a DR best strategy you want to share? Please.
Yeah, like
Joshua.
We have ours in Atlanta.
In Atlanta?
Yeah, so we have our complete DR warehouse. Everything is in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our DR strategy.
It's a secondary grid, obviously.
Right. Do you do anything from a regional DR standpoint? Like, our primary is because we do a colo.
So
the DR for our primary is in, I think, Kansas.
So we do an annual different region of the United States.
We had to do that.
Like the 2003, where you get an entire region that goes out.
Yeah, Atlanta would have been done because New York was out, Detroit was out. That's Atlanta.
But Florida and Georgia are on different grids. And so we do an annual DR recovery test. And so we test the Atlanta bottom every year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's,
Yeah,
that's best
of
my knowledge what we have.
Yeah, I just wasn't sure if region was a factor in it. Like, would you want your DR, like, if you're East Coast, would you want your DR West Coast?
Potentially.
Businesses certainly do that.
Yeah.
So, for example, anybody an Atlas customer? That was always the Atlas strategy. They had East, West, and Central for their business continuity centers. Mm-hmm. And we don't actually get involved with testing that, because that's kind of an internal part of the information technology, but that strategy is well recognized. So
Atlas is not part of Clinisys, so it'd be interesting to see if they've adopted the same strategy.
It hasn't changed. Yeah, Atlas
okay.
is part of Clinisys, but they still run pretty autonomously with inside Clinisys.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, that was a really interesting conversation. Other ideas, pie in the sky, fears. Demons, gremlins. All right.
That's it.
So, did anybody learn anybody's name? I think I learned some names, that's for sure. Thank you all for coming today for sharing.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.